Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures. Tonight we're on episode 232, and we're going to talk a little bit about our changing force. And just before we came on the podcast, we always like to shoot the breeze just ever so slightly about our topics. Not like we script it, but at least know what each other is going to kind of, where we're going with this, you know what I mean? And I guess what we've agreed upon is, regardless of what you think the reasoning is behind it, we've observed the forest is ever changing, you know what I mean? The woods is not the same as it used to be when I was a kid. I have noticed differences. Even in the areas that I used to frequent, and still frequent, I'm noticing differences. Some good, some bad. I mean, maybe it balances out in the end, but it is different, you know what I mean? And I guess that's all I really wanted to talk about on this, and kind of highlight some of the things that we've noticed, and how that may pertain to us as bushcrafters, or just woodgoers in general. It doesn't have to be us as bushcrafters, but I mean campers, bushcrafters, hikers, day trail hikers, whatever, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to acknowledge that the world is always changing, that the environment does shift and move, and sometimes that might be natural, sometimes it might be unnatural, and we really can't control that. But what we can't know about is that it does change, and sort of be aware of those changes and how they affect us and stuff. And you know a little bit more about how trees grow and all that, but you know, like, if an area goes through a burnout, there's a natural progression and how the land is usually reclaimed. And some of the first things we usually see are like blueberries,
right? Yeah.
And that type of stuff. And then what you're going to see is more fast growing plants and trees. In Newfoundland, it was alders. Alders would fill an area really quick, but they would eventually get choked out by other trees that could grow, outpace them. And then eventually sort of the peak forest in Newfoundland seemed to be the evergreen somehow. The big hardwoods never really took over because the evergreens were a bit hardier and able to out-compete for a lot of that. But go ahead.
No, I was going to say, this is one of the main things I've noticed, and that's where this conversation kind of sparked. I was talking to somebody else a little bit about how things had changed, and one of the big things I've noticed, there's less hardwood trees now. And I have my theories on that, and maybe it's just from my point of view, but where I'm at, my little, you know, my little chunk of dirt around the globe here, I notice in my area there's significantly less hardwood trees. And the hardwood trees that we do have, I find they're of, I don't want to say of less caliber, but they're like the more faster growing ones. Popple, for instance. There's a lot of popple around here now. A lot of other places are going to call that like gray aspen or trembling aspen, whatever you want to call it. Here we call it popple. I noticed there's a lot of that, but like our white maples, our rock maples, striped maple, whatever you want to call them, maple trees in general, yellow birches, white birch, even so a little bit, there seems like there's less of them. I don't know if just naturally they're dying off and not growing back, or if they're being harvested and it's just like hardwood trees take longer to grow and they're just not coming back.
There's certain trees that were probably always somewhat rare, but now you really have to look for them, like ash. Ash is not a tree you find a ton of, but it's a tree that was really important if you wanted to make things like a sturdy, strong bow or certain instruments. Like it makes a really good hard, durable wood that has some flex to it. So you could make a paddle out of it. You could make a bow out of it. It would make a decent hammer handle or something like an axe handle if you wanted, per se. So those are trees that were maybe not super plentiful before, but they disappear. And I think there's, you know, we could talk about the reasoning all day long, but there's a couple of things that we can definitely say is, one, it's not a tree that we plant.
Not often. Right? I mean, any silviculture that's done, coming from a background that used to deal a little bit in silviculture, it's generally faster growing trees. You know what I mean? Yeah. They want the fastest turnaround so they can get back in there and make some more money.
Yeah. And that's the, I had a conversation with someone not too long ago, and it's one of the things is, if you want to talk about forest management, which is a totally different subject, the last person you really want to put in charge of that is the one that's harvesting, because they're going to do the same thing that farmers do. They're going to grow the most valuable crop to them and not grow the full environment that was originally there. So forests are meant to be very diverse. And our buddy Cliff, I know he's done great episodes. And if you want to get into the where and why of a lot of this stuff, he has a great channel that talks about the environment and how things go. And so I would highly recommend you guys look him up. I can't remember the name of his channel off the top of my head, but maybe you do.
Not off the top of my head either. I got to subscribe there. I'll find it. I'll add it into the description once I find it, once we're done here. That way people can find it. So check the description of this episode. Hopefully by the time it gets uploaded, maybe not to YouTube because it's going live, but definitely by the time that makes it over to Spotify and stuff, hopefully it'll be in the description for you folks.
But he is a very intelligent man. He talks a lot about how some, you know, what it takes to make a healthy forest. And it does take a lot. And if a forest naturally grows with a normal procedure. So when we affect that, it will change that. And that, not everything we do is bad. Don't get me wrong. Like growing something is better than growing nothing. And if we leave it to its own devices after a major forest fire, it could take years for it to recover. And us going in and actively doing it, we can sometimes move it ahead a stage or two.
And that's exactly it. A lot of people, like right nowadays, especially right now, a lot of Canada's, we're in forest fires. You know what I mean? It's forest fire season here in Canada, and this year seems to be particularly bad. So a lot of these places that are burning over, if the fire's moving through really quick, it's going to kill a good majority of the mature trees. And a lot of the stunted ones, too. Like, don't get me wrong, it's just going to kill a lot of trees. But fast-moving fires, generally, they're going to burn through needles and softwoods and stuff like that. It's going to scorch a lot of the hardwoods. They may take a long time to recover from that. So a silviculture place comes in. They're like, okay, black spruce, in 50 years, we can have a full-grown tree. Let's plant a whole bunch of that. Because like you said, some trees are better than no trees. But now we're getting areas that used to be like fir and pine and other evergreens mixed with deciduous. And we're basically making them complete evergreen forests. You know what I mean? But once again, it's better than nothing.
Better than nothing. But a healthy environment is a diverse environment because it takes a lot of different animals and plants to make a healthy environment. And an interesting fact, and it's just sitting in the back of my head. Did you know that about 360 million years ago, there was nothing capable of breaking down a tree?
Like actually like felling the tree, pushing it over kind of deal, or decomposing it?
Decomposing it.
Like, oh, okay.
No tree decomposed. There was about 60 million years. I may be off on this. Anyone smarter than me feel sure. But that is where they think every bit of coal in the world came from. And it's these trees that fell down, couldn't be broken down because there were no lichens, there were no mosses, there was no fungi, there was no bacteria that could eat lichen, which is the material that strengthens the wood. Is it lichen or linen?
Liptons? I know what you mean. I can't think of the word either. Okay. Once again, smarter people will definitely comment.
But nothing could break that down. It's the cell walls of it. So it was too tough to be consumed. Then something came along that could break it down. And now it breaks it down, turns it into soil, and better and more trees can grow. If you go to a rainforest, it isn't that the rainforest land is super rich and can grow all these different trees. It's that it's really good at recycling the little bit of nutrients that's there. But yeah, we're talking about the changes. And so naturally, I mean, that's one type of change. Rivers change. Every year, a river changes. Man-made or not, if we think about it, dams happen. Like trees fall into the river, ice jams happen, water floods, pushes down into new paths. Rivers naturally form bows, and you can find those little, like, there's a type of lake that sort of forms out of where they bend and they flood over, and they build up banks and they move earth. So every year a river actually changes a few inches here and there. You know, Oxbow, is it Oxbow they call it?
Once again, smarter people will weigh in.
Yeah. But these rivers move, and that's going to change the environment. It'll wash out trees, it'll allow new trees to grow. You know, it moves nutrients from one area to the next. And these changes are constantly happening, and they have to be expected. And we get cranky with it. Like, we build near a river thinking, oh, it's beautiful, we're near a river. Well, at some point, guarantee you, that river's going to flood. It's going to take out your house. It's just whether you get 1 year or 20 years or 400 years. We don't know.
And I guess all this talk about the changes that are happening, what does that mean for us as bushcrafters? And I guess that's the other side of this conversation. I'm sure we're going to jump back and forth a little bit on this one. But like what we talked about just before we came on, was one of the big things that I also noticed is there's a lot more dead wood in the woods now. And I guess just before we move on, there's a comment here from Nomadic Hacker, and I'll address it. I was just trying to figure out a way to work it in. He asked if we have the lantern flies up here. He knows through northeastern U.S. they're really changing the landscape. So a lantern fly... if it's the one I'm thinking of, it's that little spotted bug with the red butt on it. They're really devastating a lot of the forest down there, if I'm not mistaken, Nomad. Not so much a problem here in Nova Scotia where I'm at. I don't know about your side, Ben, but I know over here we had the introduction of the longhorn spruce beetle a couple of years back, and that and the gypsy moth. There was another moth, another insect that came in here, and it really did a lot of damage. And this is another thing that's... What, dear?
Hello.
Say hi and then off to bed.
Can you see the camera?
Right there. Say hi and then off to bed.
Hi.
All right. Off to bed, you.
Hi.
It's another way that's changing the forest around here. Because like the gypsy moth, it targeted a lot of evergreens, if I'm not mistaken, fir trees. And it was, you know, wreaking havoc with the fir population. And of course, the spruce beetle, it's in its name. It's affecting a lot of the spruce trees. So that's definitely, I think we all have different invasive bugs in different areas that are changing things there. So invasive species, that's another cause. But once again, what does that kind of mean to us? So what I was talking about to Ben before we came on was I'm noticing a lot more deadfall out in the woods there. So one, that means more firewood for us when we go out into the woods. The sure, other sure. side of that means we have to be more careful when we are burning things because now we have more fuels around us. It's a little bit easier for things to get away and potentially cause problems. So it's kind of, you know, a double-edged sword there.
Yeah, and it's been a problem in Nova Scotia in particular for years because we had, almost 20 years ago now, Hurricane Juan went through.
Yep.
And in its venture through Nova Scotia, it laid waste to hundreds and hundreds of trees, thousands of trees. And, you know, 10, 15 years later, I did a search where that was one of the things. Walking through the woods was dangerous. The availability, if you could get into for a ton of basically free firewood that nobody would care, existed too, but it was too dangerous really to do much with or too far out of the way.
And just recently we've had Hurricane Fiona go through, and a lot of the lawn damage here was starting to break down to the decomposition stage. Like a lot of it was starting to get punky. But now we just dumped a whole bunch more wood on top of that. I was out for a walk in the woods after Fiona and just playing around on the ATV trails, and I was just digging through some stuff. And before I knew it, I was almost like 12 feet in the air. Just climbing over matchstick wood is what I call it. It's like where it all kind of, like you dump out a box of matchsticks. It all just kind of tangles up and you're crawling through it. Before you know it, you're quite high above the ground, which is another thing we got to be aware of with all this kind of deadfall out there is you got to watch your footing. Pretty easy to slip off something there and you'll just disappear into a hole and you're going to get banged up.
Yeah. Sent you an image of how to get the river will naturally change in shape over time.
So I'm going to bring that up here for us.
But, and as those break down, like you said, there's a period of time where moving around, it's going to be dangerous. As it breaks down, you know, there's funguses and bacteria and insects that are breaking all that down, and they're going to provide nutrients and stuff, and other trees will grow in their place. And it will be replaced, but if the temperature and environment is different as this grows, the forest that replaces it may not be the same as the forest that was originally there.
Sorry, I was just watching the image here. It's actually quite cool. I can flip that up. This is on Vox.com. So major shout out to them on this one, and hopefully this works out well. Nope, that ain't going to be it. Let's try that one. Give me 1 second there, folks. I know you're all looking at a black screen here. It's just me trying to figure it out. There we go. All right, so this is what Ben was talking about. As you can see, this little diagram here has a slider on it. It's scrolling over from 1984 to 2012. And any of you that are watching on the YouTube channel, you can kind of see how those rivers and the bends, they're expanding. Things change over time is what's basically what's happening. In the very southern part of this map, you can see an entire like lick of the river up there just disappeared because it cut across and kind of rejoined back onto itself.
Yeah. Lakes, I mean, rivers change like that, but lakes or ponds more so than lakes, but ponds will eventually fill up with sediment. And as they fill up and fill up and fill up, and that peat builds up enough, it'll become solid enough. A whole forest can grow over that. That's got nice deep soil that it can drop roots in. It's going to hold a ton of moisture in it. And a very strong and powerful forest will replace what was used to be a pond. And if you talk to some of the older guys, and you know, some of them will tell you that there used to be a pond back there, and I used to go back and get fish all the time, and I can't find it anymore. It's because it's not there. You know, the location is still there, but there is no longer a pond there. It's different. It's changed. But it probably took 60 to 100 years for it to go from being, you know, a small pond that you could almost fish to no longer being there at all.
And I wonder if this kind of goes in cycles, because one of the other things that I talked about before we came on here that I wanted to mention, so good leeway into that, is myself, I notice a lot of areas that used to have, you know, standing timber that have been harvested, or there's a lot of blowdown or stuff, I'm noticing the ground is getting naturally more saturated with water. There's a lot, I don't want to necessarily call it swampy areas, but almost swampy areas. Like, it's just a lot more wet ground out there. And, you know, the trees are now gone. The roots are kind of dying and rotting away. They're not absorbing some of the water up. I assume, the ground's just holding that saturation of water. So we're getting a lot more wetter areas. Unfortunately, none of them are deep enough for me to throw a boat in yet. But you know what I mean? I do notice a lot more damp ground out there. The waterfall is a prime example. Yes, there's a waterfall. I know there's water there, but more to where we stay at there, Ben, you even notice yourself that little gully that was in along the side of it, it was just always damp. When I first started going to the waterfall, that was nice hard ground. We had tents and stuff set up there, you know what I mean? And now it's just kind of damp. Once again, yes, I know we're beside a river, but this is happening everywhere naturally, you know what I mean? Even out in further getting to that site and stuff, I noticed there's a lot more wetter ground even going into that. Some of the places I go down here in Elma, things like that, old trails that used to be nice, hard trails, are now like the trail itself is the hard part and everything around it is just soggy all year round.
And so what we can eventually expect, I mean, is plants that need more moisture will grow in there, and plants that can't handle the moisture will rot out and die. So same as your house plants, if you overwater them, what happens? They get root rot and they die. They can't handle it. They drown, essentially. But there are other plants, things like juniper, that seem to survive really well in wet, boggy conditions. They will thrive in those areas, and that'll create a different forest, which will bring different animals and different things in, and I like to equate that to an equilibrium. And every environment, be it financial, social, physical, nature, it has an equilibrium. If you knock it off, it's going to find a new equilibrium. It may not be the one you were used to before, but that new equilibrium, it will have to be found. And that could take a while. It'll swing, it'll sway, things will change, but eventually it will stabilize into a spot that's warm. And that's where new plants might try to grow and survive, and some will fail. New animals will move in. Yellowstone, have you ever seen the video where I think someone said it's a bit of a misdemeanor, but they released wolves back in Yellowstone?
No, I haven't seen that video. Heard about this. Haven't seen it.
So there is a video. You can look it up on YouTube. But wolves were pretty well hunted out of Yellowstone. And somebody decided to put wolves back in there. And when they did, it changed the environment drastically. And one of the things it did was a lot of the animals that used to live right at the edge of the river and had been expanding the river because they were driving back the vegetation, they were driven out by the wolves. So then the forest grew up better, and then the rivers changed, and it actually changed the environment drastically. and made it a lot more like it was 100, 200 years ago. And because it was able to find a new equilibrium. And every time you change one factor in an environment, the effect can be much, much greater. And if you don't believe that, the one animal that I can bring up, and let's see if you guess what I'm thinking about, that does the most to change the environment, other than humans, that...
Do you want me to say it, or are we just waiting here? Because I got a couple guesses at this one. Beavers, man. Beavers will change the environment everywhere.
Exactly. Beavers will come in and they'll dam a river. They'll change a river drastically. They'll flood a whole area. They'll dry up another area. It'll change multiple environments for quite a ways. And it has a huge effect on the environment. And it's, you know, both positive and negative. Some areas are going to grow better. Some are going to become lakes. It'll create new vegetation or new habitat for fish and waterfowl. And other things will disappear, right?
No, 100%. But the good thing is, for us, as going out there, that potentially means we may have new places to go boating. Like, somewhere where there was only a shallow stream before, if a beaver happens to go in there and block it off, you may now have a new pond and eventually, potentially, a new lake, depending on how that water settles out. So there are some benefits to this stuff. It does change the biodiversity in there a little bit. Sometimes to the better, sometimes not so good to the better. But, I mean, it's changing. And I like the way you said it. It's kind of like a pendulum. And I think that's more what this episode was about to me, is that pendulum is swinging right now, and I guess we're noticing it. You swinging too there, but it looks like that didn't go good for a second.
But my laptop said it was the battery's dying. I thought it was plugged in, so something came loose. And yeah, I think I may have actually gotten old somewhere in the last while. Certain things I can't do.
You're not old yet, Ben. You just think you're old. But yeah, I mean, the pendulum's swinging, and that's all I really want to talk about. Yeah, there's some things changing, but it's not all bad. We're going to potentially have some new lakes. We have all that deadfall in there. We now have more firewood. We have more fire-making materials. With the change of all the major hardwoods going, like I said, the West Maple and things like that, and the rise of Popple, Popple makes great bow drills. Sam, a buddy of ours, that's how he exclusively makes his bow drills, is at a popple wood or at Tremble and Aspen, whatever you want to call it, and there's tons of dry stuff out there. I like fir and popple together. That just happens to be me, because when you mix popple and popple, you get very loud squeaking. The squeaking drives me nuts, so that's just me. It'll still work. If I was freezing, I'm using popple on popple. If I have a preference, I'll usually grab a fir spindle or something like that.
I like popple for walking sticks. It creates really straight sticks. It actually, you can use it for a ton of stuff. It grows fairly straight with very few branches, and you can easily get, because it propagates through its root system more so than anything. You never see 50 popple. You see one popple popping up 50 places.
No, I completely agree with that. And the other thing around here, what about out there? I've never asked you this, Ben. The rise of alders. Like, we have a lot of alders in Nova Scotia now. They're basically everywhere around here, as you know, just before you left. They weren't always that thick. They're kind of coming in almost as a crossbred species. Have you seen, like, that weird one? It's not really an alder. It's not really, like, a black elm or anything. It's just kind of some weird hybrid.
Yeah, I think you pointed it. A few people have pointed it. Yeah, it's not the stereotypical alder that I grew up knowing. Which, you know, anyone who's unfamiliar with alder, I mean, it is a fairly common plant, but it is a extremely fast-growing and hardy plant. And it grows almost more like a bush than a tree, unless the environment's right, but it can grow. I've seen them in Newfoundland, the biggest I think I've seen them is about 5 inches in diameter.
I was going to say, big around here is like 3-4 inches tops is the biggest I've ever seen, maybe.
But yeah, mostly you would see it probably 2 or 3 inches.
Yeah, you know, like.
And another tree that makes really good weenie roasty sticks, like the branches are great for making a little stick. Awesome for using for crafts. That's what I make my whistles out of. I think that's what I showed you with.
Sure is.
It's interesting when you debark it, it'll turn your hands red.
It's like the tannin in it or something, is it?
It must be. But yeah, the sap will react with your skin and turn it red. And it actually, it'll, as you pull the bark off, and it comes off really easy in the spring, it turns red in itself too. But yeah, it's a really neat plant. It's actually popular for smoking. So you can smoke food with it. And it burns incredibly hot. I've seen it actually destroy stoves.
I was going to say, I know my old wood stove when I lived down in the country, or more in the country than where I am now. We had some old alders out back, like the 2-inch ones.
Yeah.
I had them cut up. They were drying. I went outside for an armload of wood in the winter. I'm like, eh, I'm going to burn those up. Yeah, I turned the side of the stove red.
Yeah. Yeah, I've often seen it brighten the side of stoves and cause some serious damage to stoves. I seen an old cast iron stove actually warp with it. Which is weird. You don't see cast iron warp that often, but it can happen. So it's an interesting tree. And like you said, the ones in Nova Scotia seem to be something slightly different.
Yeah, it has a lot of the characteristics of an alder, but it's not quite an alder. It was you and I talking about this before, wasn't it?
Yeah, we have had a conversation on this. But because it's fast-growing, it's hardy. If you try to get rid of an alder grove, the only way to really do it is to rip all the root out. Like, you just cannot cut it off and think, oh, next year it'll be gone. No, next year you'll have more.
Yeah, it seems like when you cut that off, it buds out. So one branch now becomes 5. Then you cut those 5, that becomes 25. It just...
Sucker growth off these things is unreal. And we used to have a ton at Cab. Newfoundland is, especially central where I grew up, alders would grow almost anywhere. And so... I love alder. It's a great tree. I really enjoy it. But I think the thing we have to understand with the change, and coming back to that, is exactly this. As things change, it gives us new opportunities. And one of those things is new types of food, new types of wood, new types of animals. And we have to be adaptable. And I think that's the essence of bushcrafting, being adaptable to the environment. And so when you went to a forest for years, and it was always an evergreen forest, and it had a very specific feel, and you come back after a fire, and now it's a bunch of alders and blueberries, that's not the same forest. It's not that it's not a good forest. It's a great forest. It's maybe a healthy forest. But what you're going to find is that now, you know, there is blueberries. There is these alders that are really good for making roasty sticks and traps, and you can build almost anything with it because it's very flexible and pliable, and when it dries it gets very strong. So you're going to have to deal with these new woods and figure out what they can do and what they can't, and what you can bushcraft out of them. You can build some cool shelters with that one particular wood we've mentioned. In other areas you're going to deal with different things, right? And in the areas where the forests are basically laid bare right now, laid right over, it's an opportunity for so much fungus. Like, if you're into collecting fungus, which, let's be honest, if you're not, you really need to get into it.
Are you really a fun guy?
Are you?
Sorry, the dad joke. It was there. I had to do it.
I mean, within sight here, I have a couple of books on fungus identification, because honestly... it is an area that I'm interested in and I'm learning about, and I by no means claim to be an expert. If you're looking for an expert, look elsewhere. But if you're looking for an enthusiast who wants to talk about it, yeah, I'm your guy, right? Like, it's something else. And it's, you know, learning about an environment, walking into an environment and seeing what stage it is in now, and knowing how it's going to change is really going to help you in your bushcrafting career, lifetime, whatever you want to call it, hobby, because expecting everything to be exactly the same and going back and finding the exact same thing every time, well, one, that is a little boring.
Yeah.
Right? But two is you're really not getting the full education. You have to understand how things change and why they change, at least to a certain degree, so that you can understand what it's going to provide for you.
No, I completely agree. And that's the thing. This is semi-educational, I guess. I hope our podcast is semi-educational. Are we experts on this? Absolutely not. As Ben said, if you're looking for an expert, go elsewhere. We're just a couple of guys that have opinions. But I agree. If you understand it a little bit, you can kind of see the silver lining and stuff. And that's what I really wanted to stress with this was I'm not saying things are changing, it's bad, the world's changing around me and it terrifies me. No, I acknowledge things are changing. And I mean, like I said before, some's good, some's bad, but it is different. And all we got to do is just learn how to handle that differences. We've talked about the downed wood, how, you know, more fire building materials, more... just more materials in general. We can use the materials and stuff. But the other big thing is, we talked about this too right before we started, is like the weather itself changing a little bit. We've noticed here, and you and I both talked about this, is our winters, they're not as harsh anymore. The snow comes later, it leaves earlier. I think you said maybe we're still getting the same snow, maybe we're just getting it in different ways. I don't know. But I do know, like, I can remember trick-or-treating as a kid and it potentially being snowing. You know what I mean? Maybe not like a foot of snow. I can't remember that clear, but I do remember flurries and maybe a skiff of snow. So that's like the end of October. And now it's not uncommon if we have a green Christmas 2 months later. You know what I mean? And there might be a skiff of snow. That's a pretty big swing in less than 30 years.
For me, growing up, and we're talking Newfoundland, again, East Coast, but different area of the East Coast, it was not uncommon, like you said, to trick-or-treat with snow. And we would often see snow well into May. It hadn't melted. And the snow we would gather over all those months was a significant volume. And then when it melted, it meant a lot of flooding of areas and changing of areas and supplying of water to lakes and rivers for quite a while. But now, if that season is shorter, I'm not saying we're getting less of it, but that's getting dissipated over a greater period of time. Rather than holding all of it as snow for 3 or 4 months, it's only lasting for a couple of weeks, so it gets dissipated quicker, which means we're not getting as high water levels in the summer necessarily. Things are able to dry. The growing season is expected to be a bit longer, so different types of trees can survive that might not have, or plants that might not have before. And like we said, you introduce one new species to an area and it can drastically change the the area, be it a wolf or a beaver. In Newfoundland, in living memory, well, maybe not so much, but maybe so, moose were not common. Like, they weren't a thing. But in I think 1918, they released a couple of breeding pairs. And now there's, you know, probably more moose in Newfoundland than there are people, or at least a lot. And the result of that, though, means that that would have changed the environment. It changed the ecosystem. Growing up, I don't remember seeing coyote, but now there are coyote in Newfoundland. That is another.
I could be wrong on this. I think coyote might have been an introduced species here, Nova Scotia, and then it could have potentially migrated over the frozen sections towards the other islands there. I'm not 100% sure. Once again, I'm going to look this up while we're talking, because I do remember, I believe coyotes were introduced and not that long ago into Nova Scotia to try and control deer and rabbit population.
It's a possibility. The one theory that was more that it might have gotten to Newfoundland through normal means might have been from Labrador, because that would be a more shorter route and more likely to freeze. But on the island, that's something that wasn't as common. But now that it's there, and that's going to change the environment. It has to. There are many things that will change it. As weather and environment changes, animals will migrate and move differently. And that's going to further change. What our new equilibrium is not going to be the same. But as we look and see how minor changes are, we can learn to predict those changes and therefore better anticipate the things we're looking for. One of the things that was common, you ever hear cloudberries? I know I'm all over the place, but I think it's interesting. Cloudberries or bake apples, as we used to call them.
Yeah, that's what I call them too, is bake apples.
They rarely grow in the exact same place, you know, year after year. They move around. That's how they got the nickname cloudberry. And you can buy them at IKEA, so it's, you know, Northern Europe has them too. But they tend to move around a lot. And so if you're into collecting that, you kind of need to know what are the signs and where would I potentially find them? And once you find those signs, you'll be able to find them again and collect them. But you know that if you found them there last year, you're probably not going to find them there for a few years. Like, they have a sort of a cycle they go through.
Just because I have it up here, and I like to keep the facts straight as much as we can, and we can prove it here, I have the coyote little burp here. Were they introduced? No. I was mistaken. They migrated here due to changes in North America, such as land clearing, railroad, right-of-ways, etc. The prairie coyote in the late 1800s began range expansion that reached Nova Scotia in 1976, thereabouts. So we didn't have coyotes up until the late 70s. I thought it was the 80s. And yeah, I guess it is kind of a common misconception they were introduced. They just kind of migrated into this area, but we didn't have them until the 80s. And it was the changing of North America, the changing of our forests, that potentially brought them in here, just to kind of prove our point. You know what I mean? Like, things change. We now have new wildlife here that we didn't have before, much like you have in or had in Newfoundland. Holy man, I couldn't think of that for the life of me. Ticks. We've talked about this before. There was no ticks on Newfoundland.
No.
Now there is. You know what I mean?
Right. Some of these animals were introduced. Some are a result of just human movements. So some of them probably came over on people and got dropped off. Coyotes, there is a theory that somebody brought coyotes to Newfoundland to control the caribou and moose for the, you know, the lumber industry. I don't personally believe that's a likelihood. But my cabin in Nova Scotia, not that I want to advertise exactly where it's to, but I have one. There's a lake that when I first moved there did not have pickerel.
I was gonna say perch and pickerel are the big invasive ones here.
Yeah,
or I don't know if they're invasive, but they're the ones that seem to like take everything over.
There was perch in that lake when I got there, and there was bass, but there was no pickerel. Now there's pickerel. It's going to change that area. Right now the pickerel are small and plentiful, but eventually we assume there'll be bigger ones. And you know, there's still, you know, some of those other fish, but I didn't see a lot of perch this year when I was there.
And good, bad, or otherwise, it is changing, but that's now a new potential food source that's coming out of that area. I don't know how it'll affect the other fish in that area. Not a, you know, that's beyond my scientific method of study, because I'm pretty limited at that. I don't pretend to be an expert on how fish habitat works, but on the outside looking in, at least, or not at least, but there is another type of fish there that now you can potentially have some recreational fishing with. A friend of ours, Gary, I think he was out there, and he was the one that was having some pretty good luck pulling a variety of fish out of that lake that we're talking about, was he not?
Yeah, Gary may have gotten a good fish out of there too. I can either confirm or deny, but that's up to Gary to confirm. So, you know, there's a lot of things. One of the most common major change to any environment, of course, is fires. And we talked a bit about that, you know, the natural cycle. And there are trees that cannot regrow without fire.
I was just going to say, one of the things in the Forest Service, as forest firefighters, when I used to do it, that they tell us is there is a lot of biodiversity that is brought behind a fire. Yes, incredibly destructive force, but they do bring a lot of things behind it. Porter's Lake area here in Nova Scotia. It was originally one of the largest fires with urban interface, basically crossing into a living area. That's now changed with a lot of the fires that have been happening over the last few years. But at the time, it ripped through an area there just down the 107 highway. And I was just going down there not too long ago, maybe a couple of weeks ago, and I was looking through it, and these were the old stomping grounds when I was fighting this fire. And I'm noticing how a lot of the forest and vegetation there have changed. For a couple of years, it was barren. Like, it looked like a fire had gone through, funny enough. But now it's actually starting to get pretty lush. Are the tall standing timber there now? No, they burned down, but there's a lot of other shrubbage and fruit plants, like you said. There's a lot of raspberry, there's a lot of blueberry, there's a lot of blackberry, there's a lot of apple trees I'm noticing coming up, or apple bushes more specifically. They're not growing into trees, they almost seem to be like bush-like crabapple trees. There's a lot of interesting vegetation that's now starting to come in behind there. Granted, the fire was in 2013. It took a little time, 10 years to be exact, but things are changing in there. It's starting to thrive again. A lot of animals are coming back into there that were kind of scared away from the fires. We lost a lot of wildlife in that fire. A lot of it's starting to come back, and they're starting to thrive in those areas.
Well, like you said, like the very stuff you just brought out is that it's plants that provide a lot of food. You know, there's tons of songbirds and small mammals that thrive on berries and fruit and stuff like that. And so that's going to bring so much more stuff in. Where a forest of just pine or just spruce, not much can live in that.
Bugs.
You won't.
Softwood forest bring bugs.
But even that, it's a fairly limited number of bugs. Where this other forest you just mentioned, there's going to be a plethora of insects and stuff that'll bring in more and more animals, and it's going to be a very healthy and vibrant area. And that's a good thing. Jack pine was the plant I thought about, because the cones won't even open up unless placed under heat.
Okay, so now they're more open, they're getting that warmer areas. And that's the thing, when a lot of the big vegetation burns off or is destroyed or harvested or whatever happens, a lot of that low-lying shrubbage that's been strangled for so long now has the opportunity to get a lot more of those nutrients and actually get a lot more sunshine, and you start seeing that stuff pop out. Granted, when a fire rips through, they take a pretty bad brunt of the fire as well. But in a lot of places where they do some forestry, they're harvesting, providing they're using ethical harvesting methods and things like that, you know, whatever their cutting preference happens to be, they're now allowing a lot more of that sun to hit the forest floor, which is allowing for a lot more varieties of vegetation to come back. Once again, is it good or bad? Debatable. Whatever side of the coin you are on there, so be it, but it is allowing things to happen.
Yeah. No, and that's exactly it. So, yes, forests change. Lakes come, lakes go, ponds come, rivers move, fire, you know, forests burn down, they change as environment changes, other plants can outcompete and knock them down. All this happens, you know, for thousands of reasons. It's not good or bad. We're not saying it's good or bad, but 100% each change is a new opportunity.
And I mean, we're coming up on 45 minutes. I never expected this to be a long topic, but just so people know that we do have a point to this, because we have mentioned a few, but just things to remember. If you're looking for, okay, why are we talking about change? Because I know somebody out there saying that. But I mean, with that change, like we said, there's now more materials out there to use. There's potentially more bugs, good or bad. We have had a rise in ticks, but we also have had a rise in other bugs that you can use potentially for baiting and things like that. There are changing in fruit plants that are coming out there, and maybe you need to be more observant to the fruit plants that are now becoming more plentiful in your area when you're getting out there. I mean, for me, when I used to go out, I was always looking for, like, blackberries, raspberries, blueberries. You know what I mean? But serviceberry or teaberry, whatever you want to call it, that tree is starting to come back a little bit more in Nova Scotia, so you can start finding those. Chokecherries. There's a lot of chokecherry trees coming back because they're getting a lot more sun and stuff like that, and they're starting to grow up a little bit more. So you're going to be able to pull, you know, different resources while you're out there if you're gathering food. As Ben said, fungus. With a lot of that dead rotting stuff in the woods, we're getting a lot more funguses show up here. And if you know your fungus and stuff like that, that's potentially providing you opportunities for a variety of different things. Polyporous. You can make polyporous tea. Chaga, that's a whole other topic, and I think that's been beaten to death in other places. It comes and goes, but you can make tea with that. It's a fire-making material. I'm thinking like the turkey tail. Is it called turkey tail fungus? I can't remember what it is. But anyway, it's a great fire starter. Horseshoe fungus growing on a lot of this down dead stuff. That's another great fire starter. These are all things that are now becoming very plentiful, which before this happened, it may be harder to find those things. So a lot of opportunities are coming with these changes, providing that you're aware of the changes, why the changes are happening, and what advantages those changes can bring you. Does that kind of sum it up?
Yeah. It's, I mean, I said, you know, it brings new opportunities, and that's what we have to, like, I think the essence we said earlier too is bushcrafting is about being adaptable. And these changes are interesting and educational. There's something neat in the comments?
No, just Fish85 repeated the joke back to me. He said, there's a lot of fun guys among us. You're late to the party, Fish. I already said it earlier. You can't pull one over on me that quick. Yeah, so Steve just said, there's an amazing amount of chanterelles this year, like chanterelle mushrooms. There is a massive amount of those this year. I noticed fiddleheads were super plentiful this year, and they went later into the season. Funny story, I have fiddleheads literally growing right outside my garage. Most people don't believe me until they come over and they're like, oh, hell, yeah, you do got fiddleheads literally growing outside your garage. Those things went like 3 weeks later than they should have. And some people are like, oh, well, 3 weeks, that's not that long. When it comes to fiddleheads, 3 weeks is a long time, seeing you basically get a week, 2 weeks when they're actually okay to get out there and harvest them, when they're not, you know, super bitter. If anybody doesn't know what a fiddlehead is, it's a type of fern, a very specific fern. Not all ferns are edible, but this one, you can harvest it before the fern unravels. As long as you soak it in water, get some of that bitterness out of it and cook it properly, it's perfectly edible to eat. Kind of tastes like a little bit like asparagus, but I know, anyway, long story short, I noticed that there was a lot more of that. And that it stayed for a lot longer this year. Why? That's debatable, but it was there and it stayed for longer. So normally I don't get to have a feed of fiddleheads. I always miss it. This year I got to have some fiddleheads.
I haven't had a good feed in years. But yeah, no, I mean, when the bushcraft weekends, we found a ton of them, didn't we?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's really hit and miss when the, well, it's not hit and miss. It's usually like, about a month ago now is about when they rolled out, I guess. So would that be, this is August, September, like the end of July, mid end July, I guess. I'm literally just pulling dates from here. I generally look at mine outside the garage and see how they're doing and base everything on that. But yeah, So once again, lots of stuff out there. I also tried cattail root a few weeks back for the first time. Tasty stuff. 100%. What I was talking about with these wetlands, there's a lot more wetter land out there. Not wetlands like swamps and stuff, but wetter land. There is a lot more bulrush or cattail that's growing. And it's one of the wonderful things out there in the woods that, depending on the time of year, it always has a use. The tubules at the bottom off it, as long as you get, you know, they're not slimy, if you can get down to the soft inner core, that stuff actually tastes pretty good, just as Steve said. I don't mind eating it. It's kind of like a... It has the texture of like palm heart, but the taste is kind of unique to itself. I don't know how to describe it, but it's very edible. And then as it gets later in the year and starts drying out, it's the only thing I've been able to find around here that I can use a hand drill to make a fire with. It's not easy stuff to use, but you can use it. I have a video on there on our channel that shows me using a piece of bulrush or cattail, whatever you want to call it. And of course, the big fluffy ends on them, you can use that as insulation as it gets later in the fall. If you get out there and you start getting cold, you start pulling that stuff off. Yes, it's messy. It sticks to everything. But you start jamming that in your clothes, you add a lot of insulation value to it.
Oh, yeah. As I say, you find cattails, you're safe.
They are a wonderful thing.
You can make almost anything. It's really good for basket weaving.
Melissa uses it for making cordage. She loves like the leaves off it. If they're not too dry, she can roll those into cordage and makes wonderful tight cordage out of it too. Yeah, that's actually a good call there, Steve. They're almost a bit cucumberish in their taste. The roots, if you want to dry them, wash them off really good, dry them, pound them out, and that kind of white milkish mush that's left over, if you dry that a few times, you can literally make a flour out of it, or more specifically, what I've used it for is like, it's just a starch. It's basically pure starches. Soup thickener. You know what I mean? Which is basically flour. If you put it into a watery soup, you can thicken that up and it makes it a little heartier. That's one of the tricks that I love to do with cattail. If anybody out there is looking for, you know, what piece of information can you specifically pull out of this podcast? Is if you dry out the roots of bulrush and make it into a flour, it is a wonderful soup thickener, which adds a ton of starch. Take that for what it's worth. I mean, in the woods, starches and sugar is not a bad thing. You're burning a lot of calories. Sitting around home watching TV, probably don't want that much starch and natural sugars going into your body.
Yeah. There's an argument if you want to get into that. Like, at least with some of these starches, they're more complex.
Mm.
It's harder to digest, which means that it lasts over a longer time, where the refined sugars are immediate blast, and you know, there's ups and downsides to that. But yeah, 100%. Yeah, different plants can happen different things. And again, back to our topic, and I think we can wind it up now.
Yep.
Because we are definitely, is, yeah, change is natural. All changes may not be caused by natural reasons, but we naturally will always see changes in our environment. And learning to adapt to those changes is a huge part of bushcrafting. And learning to see the advantages of them and learning how to leverage that to your benefit is an amazing skill for bushcrafters. So when you see something change, look at it and learn from it and take the time to really understand it, because it's going to give you something in return. And one of those big things is the opportunities for new foods, new materials, new learning opportunities. And that's what it is, right? Bushcrafting is learning that stuff. And understanding that you are never going to enter the same forest twice. Every time you enter the forest, it's slightly different. Sometimes it's going to be greatly different, right?
No, 100%.
We've both done it. We both walked through the same geographical area and at some point in time looked at us ourselves and said, this is nothing like it was 20 years ago.
No, 100. Well, that's exactly what sparked this conversation I was having with somebody earlier before I messaged you and said, hey, you want to talk about this tonight? It was literally, I was talking about somewhere down home and I said, I was just there not that long ago and man, it is completely different. I was talking to a buddy of mine. We were talking about places we were as kids. This happened to be a gravel pit that was down home. That gravel pit's no longer there. It's been reclaimed by nature. You know what I mean? Because I've went into this gravel pit to see if it was still there, and it is not.
It is.
It is. It's just different.
Greenery. But yeah, no, same thing with me. Areas I grew up, if you go back, some of the areas that were, you know, great blueberry fields and stuff, you can go back now and it's a small forest and it, you know, there is no blueberries and that's fine. It's part of that natural development of that land and it can't stay the same, because one of the things we know, and farming proved this, if you grow the exact same thing year after year in the exact same area, you will kill the land.
Yeah. That's why farmers rotate crops.
Right. And so we learned that. And that's the same thing that happens in a forest. It starts off as one thing, it gradually changes to another, 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 and eventually it'll burn down and we'll restart the whole cycle. But at that point, the nutrients and stuff that built up is a different land than it was before. It's probably less rocky. It's more soil now because it's built up of all the leaves and stuff that's fallen over the years. And now a different forest can grow back. And that's fine. Yeah. Anyways, change, it happens. Get used to it. Yeah, and be careful, because, you know, when the forest is dry, we can cause change that we didn't intend to. Because it's our job as bushcrafters to leave it to happen naturally.
And that's just it. I mean, change is going to happen. Change happens. Like Ben said, just try not to be the literal match to that change.
We practice, me and you especially, we practice like a leave no trace thing. We aren't the catalyst. We go in, we visit those forests, we learn about those forests, and we leave. And we realize that it's going to change the next time we come back. But we just don't want to see that we changed it when we come back, that we caused a major change to that area. And the biggest one, of course, is fires. But there's plenty of other things we can do when we go in. Going into a river system and blocking it off with rocks so you have a bigger place to swim, that changes the environment.
And, just in the area where you're at. You don't know what that's doing down or upstream.
Yeah, 100%. And so be aware, when you make a change, you move a rock or you cut down a tree, you're changing the environment, and it may not be the same when you go back. It's that those changes could be bigger than you intended.
Yeah, I think that's as good a place as any to leave it on that last little tidbit of wisdom there from Ben. So, anything else you want to add into the end of this, Ben?
No, surprising topic. I'm not surprised we went as long as we did. And I know we could have gone longer, but yeah, I think it was an interesting conversation.
I agree. So what about you folks out there, our listeners, viewers, everybody from east to west, all around the globe? What's your thoughts on this? How do you feel about change? What's some stories about change that you've had in your area? We'd love to hear that kind of stuff. We do get some emails. We listen to the stories that people tell us. We love to hear it. And if it's something we can use on the show, providing it's, you know, appropriate, we would be more than happy to share it on the show and give you full credit for it. So definitely reach out to us. You can find all that stuff down below or into the comments if you're listening to this on one of the audio files there. But yeah, that's it for me tonight. So I guess on my end, get out there, have fun, play safe, let us know about it.
Night all, enjoy, get out there, have fun.
Night everybody, we'll see you next week. And thanks to everybody that joined us in the comments there. Nomad Fish, Steve, and I think Danny joined us there a little earlier too. So just saying hi to all those folks again. We'll see you all next week. Night everybody.